by a sniper in the Israeli occupation army. So that's why you are sitting there in this set right now. We thank you for your effort, for being there. Please do consider yourself as a representative for all of us who are now mourning Shireen and the loss of Shireen. Now, Mr. Anis, Saif al-Quds carried special and exceptional features that distinguished it from other previous confrontations, constituting a defining moment in the entire history of the Palestinian struggle and the developments in the entire region, to be honest with you. What achievements have the Palestinians been able to attain in 2021 or since the 2021 Saif al-Quds confrontations?
The most important achievements of the Palestinian people after Saif al-Quds, or God willing, at the beginning of the liberation, is the unification of the entire Palestinian people under the banner of resistance to the racist Zionist entity. The entity that tried using barbed wire fences and blockades to attempt the conversion of families to separate the Palestinian people from each other and impose a new state in Palestine for its settlers, which it refers to as the Israeli citizens on our land, the land of Palestine. Our Palestinian people truly triumphed because their identity is one, especially that the uprising included all of full historical Palestine. It covered over 27,000 square kilometers, not only in the West Bank, or in Gaza, or in Al-Quds, or Galilee, or the Negev, but all of Palestine was united. This was the most important achievement, because our national identity have existed for thousands of years. And we know that no matter how much the entity tried to isolate us within the occupied territories, we broke that isolation through the sword of Al-Quds. The second important achievement is the emergence of new generations fixated on the resistance approach. These generations have not previously been involved in the uprisings after the Second Intifada in 2005. The battle sword of Al-Quds helped engage this generation in the uprising. They did not take part in Earth Day or the First or Second Intifada. Saif al-Quds allowed us to discover this generation inside 1948 Palestinian territories, which proved that they are not afraid of the Zionists, a generation that is more courageous and not afraid of the racist entity.
Mr. Anis, Saif al-Quds battle still represents the most prominent strategic shifts in the conflict with the occupation so far, as it was able to consolidate the failure of the deterrence policy claimed by the Israeli authorities against the Palestinian natives and push towards more cohesion with the occupation, which was basically evident in the escalation of the individual resistance operations inside the interior occupied Palestinian territories, especially in the first few months of 2022. Were the native Palestinians capable of investing quite well the Saif al-Quds battle in maybe strengthening their steadfastness in the face of the occupation?
A real investment for any Palestinian is defending himself and his identity, and living freely within a free Palestinian state. Real investment is in the struggle, the continuity of the struggle. Saif al-Quds gave us all a motivation that did not exist before. It's truly a battle that strategically shifted the level of deterrence. Certainly, the Israeli entity attempts to show itself in a position of power or victory, miserably failed. The biggest proof of this is the killing and the assassination of journalist Shireen Abu Aqli, who was only doing her job and covering the entity storming into the Jenin refugee camp. As usual, when the entity is not able to confront the Palestinian resistance or resistance in southern Lebanon or any resistance from the rest of the region, it turns to killing children, nurses, and journalists in order to create a state of deterrence. The descent of the Palestinian people to the street, and the preparations for a new uprising in Al-Quds during the funerals of the martyrs proved that the Palestinian people have taken the decision to remain free, whatever the price may be. This is the message of our Palestinian people, a practical one from the ground, not just talk.
Mr. Anis, this comprehensive battle in Al-Quds and in Gaza and the West Bank and the interior 1948 occupied territories was able to establish the Palestinian right for Al-Quds and to refute the occupation's narrative of its right to Judaize Al-Quds and its neighborhood, and led to the formation of what we now know as the regional axis of Al-Quds, known as Mihwar Al-Quds, in which all West Asia's axis of resistance is on board. Now, if Zionist Israel maintains its current provocations against the worshippers of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds, might we witness an all-out regional war in support of Al-Aqsa, in support of Al-Quds?
It's possible to see a war, but not because of the peoples of our region. The history of the peoples in our region testifies for thousands of years that they love peace. We are a peace-loving people. But the actions of the Zionist entity is what pushes the peoples of the region for fighting with this entity. Al-Quds today is the compass of the free world. Al-Quds is a symbol for the cause of the oppressed people of the world. Al-Quds is a symbol of the state of oppression of the Palestinian people. Of course, I respect the heavenly sanctity of Al-Quds, but I speak at the level of humanity, and especially for the oppressed people. How Al-Quds has national symbolism for them. The Zionist entity is the one who always seeks war in the region. Since the infiltration of the Zionist entity into our region, we have never seen a day of peace, neither here nor in the world. This war is a war imposed on the peoples of our region because of the racist state, which is the occupying entity. Just like the Nazis were eliminated in Europe, just as Daesh was eliminated in our region, we must get rid of Zionism in our region.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Anis Safouri, former Palestinian detainee, who spent 12 years in illegal Zionist detention centers and activist in the Abna al-Balad movement. Thank you very much for being with us, despite the fact that you are visiting our very appreciated martyr, Shireen Abu Aqli, at the hospital. Thank you for giving us the time to be with us and talk to us. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about how the Zionist entity assassinated in cold blood a journalist.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Shireen Abu Aqli was a household name across the Arab world, literally, across the region and beyond. Her calm, commanding presence filled living rooms, courtyards, and camps as viewers turned to the new Al Jazeera Network 24-hour Arabic TV news channel. Joining in 1997, a year after its launch, Shireen made her own history. For a new generation of young Arab women who came of age then and are now a driving force in journalism, she was the first female correspondent they've seen on their television screens. Shireen Abu Aqli was assassinated in cold blood by an Israeli sniper while covering a raid by Israeli occupation forces on Jenin camp in the occupied West Bank. Shireen's martyrdom became a powerful and painful reminder of the huge and growing price paid by journalists covering the continuous Palestinian struggle against the monstrous Zionist occupation. More in this following report.
Veteran Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Aqli has been shot and killed by Israeli forces while reporting in Jenin in the occupied West Bank. The assassination last Wednesday sparked an outpouring of condolences and condemnation, as well as calls for a thorough investigation to hold the occupation to account. In a statement, Al Jazeera Media Network condemned the blatant murder that violates international laws and norms and called Abu Aqle's death a heinous crime through which it is intended to prevent the media from fulfilling its message. Al Jazeera also held the Israeli government and the occupation forces responsible for the intentional targeting and killing of Abu Aqle. Al Jazeera Network said that the Israeli soldiers targeted its correspondent with a direct shot. It quoted eyewitnesses as saying that a sniper targeted Shireen with a bullet in the face, even though she was wearing a jacket and helmet bearing the logo of the press, and that the Israeli soldiers fired live bullets at the demonstrators and press crews. Journalist Ali Samoudi, who was accompanying Abu Aqle and was shot in the upper back, said, "What happened is that we were on our way to cover the Israeli army operation. Suddenly, they shot at us. They didn't ask us to leave. They didn't tell us to stop. They shot us. A bullet hit me. A second bullet hit Shireen. They killed her in cold blood because they are killers." Ali added in a video recording sitting in a wheelchair at the hospital with bandages on his shoulder. Shireen's body was carried through the streets of Jenin, draped in the Palestinian flag with the press jacket she was wearing. Reporters and photojournalists circled the funeral, this time having to cover the death of one of their own. Shireen was a much-loved reporter and one of the region's most experienced. Her familiar face has always been part of the coverage of major events in the region, and generations of Palestinians have grown up watching her on television as one of the most famous correspondents in covering the continuous Zionist aggression on Palestine. Abu Aqle is considered one of the veteran Arab journalists, and since joining Al Jazeera, she has covered most of the prominent events in the Palestinian territories, and she was one of the most famous war correspondents. After her death, a number of tweeters expressed their grief over her death, and some of them said that they considered her as a member of their families due to her great influence and her long presence on screen. The martyrdom of colleague Shireen Abu Aqle is a crime that has been added to the criminal record of the Zionist entity, and it is imperative for the media and journalist body to unite to denounce it and to make it our duty to amplify the suffering of the Palestinian people so the entire world can hear and see the brutality of the occupation.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Julia Qasim, political writer and commentator. Thank you for being with us. Now, blue body armor emblazoned with the word press in bold white letters placed on her wooden coffin, on the coffin of our slain martyr journalist, Shireen Abu Aqle. It was a powerful and a painful reminder that journalists are paying a heavy price because of the Israeli continuous brutal aggression against all of Palestinians, but especially against journalists. I don't understand why the world acted surprised when Shireen was assassinated, as if this is something that Israel does for the first time. Why do you think the mainstream media dealt with her assassination the way it did?
Right. As you said, it's far from being the first time. 50 journalists at least have been assassinated just since 2000. And this doesn't include notable cases before that date, such as the 1987 murder of Najih El-Ali. But as we're getting to a point, especially where in this time where the Israel's war crimes are documented out in the open, and this started to proliferate after the introduction of media in Palestine, of Arab media, of Palestinian media, proliferating in the mid to late 1990s, that also accompanied the rise of the internet, it posed like more of a threat for Israel to maintain its pretext of democracy and civilization in the Middle East, and more clearly exposed its the reality of its incessant war crimes. And so the mainstream media basically is in a walking contradiction because it wants to present itself as the authoritative voice on objectivity, but at the same time, it's accountable to capital, it's accountable to empire, and it's accountable to the military-industrial complexes of the United States and Israel, which it maintains a close relationship with their military apparatus and with their intelligence apparatuses, which essentially drive its lines. So this accountability creates this contradiction where there is a denial of the injustices that are happening to Palestinians. At the same time, the world can see its war crimes out in the open, as they have been. So these are also reflected in the editorial guidelines of mainstream media, which deliberately leave no space for the Palestinian narratives, the recognition for Palestinians as the sovereign owners of the land, and of course, as ones that are being ethnically cleansed by the settler colonial occupation.
There's something interesting that happened where Israel cannot lie about it anymore, as you just clearly stated, Julia. But Shireen's colleague and one of the eyewitnesses of her assassination is journalist Ali Samoudi, who was injured himself during that day, said that the occupation deliberately killed Shireen and injured the rest of the crew, even though the place was free of any protesters, demonstrators, or even people throwing stones, for that matter, in the area. Why do you think the occupation assassinated Shireen in specific?
So there is the aspect of Shireen being a prominent journalist, as you said, for all these years, who was a trailblazer in her field, but also an iconic figure that exposed the Zionist war crimes, essentially, in her profession by reporting from on the ground. And being front and center in showing the world what was happening to the Palestinians. So there was her as a figure that was a deliberate target. Second, there's the contextual element of Jenin and of the West Bank facing a renewed and increased siege from the Zionist entity after the resistance forces of, after the Palestinian resistance have consolidated their alliance and are working in unity, particularly after last year's Safe of Jerusalem occupation, successfully and to a level that is a very big threat to the Zionist entity. And the specific site that Shireen was reporting on just last Wednesday when she was martyred was a Zionist attack on the Jenin camp. Mm-hmm. Where there also was a 18 and a 21-year-old murdered, representing also the demographic of young resistance fighters that are posing the biggest threat to the Zionist entity, fighting in armed struggle against the occupation.
Which this brings us to how the Palestinian Authority dealt with it. I mean, I heard and I read for Prime Minister Mohammed Ishtaye, who called for an international investigation involving what he called the United Nations and various parties into also what he called the murder of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Aqle. Why is the PA still believing that the so-called international community can bring justice to any Palestinian cause is truly a mystery to me. I mean, entire neighborhoods were wiped out in Gaza last year during the Israeli aggression on Gaza after the resistance tried to help out al-Quds with Saif al-Quds, and not a word came out from this international community. Why should this case be any different?
Right, there's a certain level of hypocrisy that came out of certain officials representing the Palestinian Authority to the UN and to international agencies such as like Riyad Mansour, who were rejecting the possibility of an Israeli probe into attack while at the same time calling for example, the UN or some others were calling for the U.S. to do an investigation. Of course, even if this investigation turns up any modicum of truth more than Israel's potential investigation would, which I don't expect it to really have any different objectives in doing so as allies in maintaining the occupation. But it's just a way for them to kind of maintain their role as the auxiliary representatives of the Palestinian bourgeois class that has basically sold out the sovereignty of Palestinians and of Palestine in exchange for just kind of like some elite control. But also appealing to the international community is increasingly popular in this regard because the U.S. and the EU can kind of claim to also be impartial in relegating the Palestinian, the issue of the occupation of Palestine and of the injustices that come out of that as a human rights issue rather than a sovereignty issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely hear that, especially that in the international law, Palestine is occupied, but in their notions and in their understanding, it's not. So we're not going to wait for them to understand it, that it is. I want to thank you very much, Julia Qasem, political writer and commentator from Beirut, joining us to talk about the assassination of Shireen Al-Aqli while doing her job, exposing the Zionist entity who was trying to storm Jenin camp last week. Thank you very much for being with us, Julia. Thank you for your contribution. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be examining a question. And this question is related to one of the surahs, one of the chapters of the Holy Quran. As you know, one of the chapters of the Holy Quran is the chapter which is known as Surah An-Nas, which is often roughly translated as the men. This is the last surah of the Holy Quran, and in this surah, God Almighty asks the Prophet, and indirectly asks us, to seek refuge in himself from the whisperings, from the insinuations, from the temptations of the devil. And in the beginning of this surah, God Almighty, he mentions this three times in three different ways, right? See, in other words, he mentions himself and asks us to take refuge in him, but he refers to himself in three different ways. He refers to himself as Rabbin Nas, the Lord of men, Malikin Nas, the king of men, or the ruler or sovereign over men, and Ilahin Nas, the God of men, or the object of worship of men. So the question we want to ask today is, why is it that God Almighty has mentioned or referred to himself or alluded to himself by means of these three distinct and different divine names? In general, we can say that, by way of introduction, that everything, every word in the Quran, every letter in the Quran, every phrase that the Quran uses, it alludes to a certain meaning, right? A lot of times we casually, you know, read the Quran and just glance at the verses of the Holy Quran without taking a note of the distinctions between some of the verses which seem to be the same and similar and, you know, repetitions of one another. Whereas in reality, this is not the fact. This is something that's been discussed in the science of eloquence or the science of balaghat, and also in some of the Quranic commentaries which kind of focus on distinguishing between these seemingly repetitive verses. But this is just something that we like to mention here in general terms. Right. So having said that, we can say that when God Almighty refers to himself with a certain attribute, with a certain sifat, it definitely alludes to a certain point. And actually, we might say that the sifat or the attribute that God is referring to himself with, it serves as the reason for the ruling that's preceded it, right? So we can illustrate it by the verse in question, and it also, this is also an answer to the question. So when God Almighty says, "Qul a'udhu bi rabbin nas," I say, I seek refuge in the Lord of men, right? It's also referring to the reason why we should seek refuge in God, because he's the Lord of men, meaning because God Almighty is the Lord of men. When we say Lord, meaning he's the being that sustains men, takes care of men, takes care of human beings, and takes care of their needs, right? This is the reason why we should seek refuge in him, right? We shouldn't seek refuge in a person who has nothing to do with us, who doesn't sustain us, who doesn't take care of us, whose function and whose responsibility is not our well-being, right? Rather, we should seek refuge in the person and in the being whose function it is to take care of us and to nurture us. Right? Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the first three verses of Surah Nas and its meaning. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. A very warm welcome to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality, where we discuss the most controversial topics, the most interesting topics, wherein we have a roundtable discussion. Today also, we're going to have something like that. I'm your host, Zainab. I have with me Fatima from California and Siddiqa from the UK. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaykum salam.
Very warm welcome to the show. And today, since we are all women standing around the table, let's discuss something about the women. Well, Fatima, when we search about the women on the internet, we really don't get some pleasant stuff all the time. What do you find when you search about women on the internet?
I'm sure you've heard of Katie Price.
True.
Right? She appears in the news a lot.
True.
She was married to Andre before. I'm sorry I'm going into this. But she was more of a porn actress.
Mm-hmm.
And there seemed to be a time when her husband couldn't take it anymore. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, how many husbands are going to allow that, you know, they own someone who they value as their wife, does indecent acts with other men. And then they divorced. You know, they had their fights, they divorced. Miley Cyrus, famous actress. So many breakups. you showing your flesh is not going to give you happiness. True. It's just going to allow you to make a statement, which tomorrow you might end up regretting because it didn't give you honor, it didn't give you justice, it didn't give you money. Mm-hmm. All it allowed was for a man to feast on your body.
And the husbands get jealous.
Well, Fatima, I would want to ask you, the world is showing women, the world is persuading actually women to like wear less clothes, show more of our flesh, show more of our body, show more of our beauty. And there might be someone behind earning all this, because, you know, if a woman is starting to showing off her body, she needs more of this waxing kind of kit. She needs something to straighten her hair, to make curly her hair, to color her hair. The more she is revealing herself, the more she has to spend.
Makeup, yeah.
And the more she has to spend, someone behind the scenes is getting benefited, actually. I would want to ask you, on the one side, once we are being shown that the women should be like wearing less clothes, should be showing off and all stuff, on the other end, we are being shown. In fact, it's being so many advertisements are being done over the note that the more the women are in hijab, the more oppressive she is.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this concept is being highlighted day by day? The more a woman is Islamic, the more she's following the rules. Even the Muslim women, the so-called modern Muslim women we have today, they have their own, I don't know, rulings. Do you think something is going on one end, the nudity is being advertised so much, mm-hmm. and on the other end, women in hijab are being shown as oppressed?
I think to a certain degree, and also I feel like in the U.S., I'm not as much sure about other places, but in the U.S. and coming towards this part of the world too a lot, it's being shown as the woman who's wearing good hijab, she cannot be successful in the career world unless she's maybe just going to be like, I don't know, like a Hausa teacher or like, you know, just her own business sitting at home or something. Like, she cannot be successful in this society financially, like getting a good job, a career, because most of the women who have so high paying jobs and career are dressing like this, you know, maybe in the medical field, like a nurse or something like this, but other places she cannot, like, it's emphasized, like, you're not gonna, no one's gonna give you a job. And that's why I'm seeing, which is really heartbreaking and sad, a lot of the young girls, like I'm seeing, I was a teacher assistant at a private Shia Islamic school in Southern California for a while, and I was seeing a lot of these young girls in the high school ages. They're seeing that no one's going to give them a job. They're looking around, or when they first graduate from university, it's tough to find that first job, and they're not, nobody's giving, and, you know, they're facing discrimination, especially in Southern California. There's only certain areas of that have higher population of Muslims. People are like, you know, make fun of them. Like in the street, they'll yell at you. Some people will go back home where you came from. We are home, you know.
We'll be back after a short while.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Well, Sadiqa, what's your take on that? What do you think? What are your initial thoughts when you see, on one side, the nudity being so much propaganda being made about it, and on the other side, the hijabi woman being shown as the most oppressed and more backward, I must say.
So going to the work environment, having been through university myself, I was in a university in Birmingham and in the UK, and then I worked for a few years. It is very important for us to have discrimination laws in our countries. And this comes down to those who are politically savvy in our communities to go and lobby, get these discrimination laws introduced so that any woman who has the brains, she has the intellect, she has the experience, is able to be hired in a company that she wants to work in, and she should not be judged based on her hijab. So yes, we do need change. We have these discrimination laws in the UK, right?
But how much are those being practiced?
They are being practiced, but we do really need to get them. It's also, you know, if a woman wants to be bold, this is where she should start. Right?
All right.
Go through university. get the experience you need. And if a company shuts you down based on your hijab, you go stand against them, take them to court, and make sure you get the job. This is what is called being bold.
All right.
So if a woman wants to really show how bold she is, she should start by changing the trend that we have in our society today. Women are forced fed this idea. If you wear the hijab, you won't get a job. If you go to university, you're basically wasting your time because you're not going to get a job. We are force fed this idea, and we need to break away from this. Get a job, get into the company, and if they don't allow you a job, take them to court. You'll be successful. And this is where we need to start showing more boldness.
Being naked and these is easy. Laws are taking, not being so much publicized. You know, we don't know about these
In the
laws.
UK, they are, because we have a lot of discrimination. We've had discrimination cases.
All right.
And before you go to the court, you can sort it out in one of the lower courts, I believe. I forget the name right now, unfortunately. But you have out-of-court settlements for discrimination cases. But, you know, getting this news out in the press, you know, if a company does not hire on the basis of discrimination, then we can, you know, the newspapers are the best, social media is like the most powerful form of information today.
Yeah.
Get it out, get the word out that women need to become bolder in these cases. Do not allow other people to make you feel what you should feel.
True.
If you believe, you know your faith is telling you hijab is wajib. True. You believe in it, you want your hijab. Why do you want to please someone else for the sake of a job when you can easily get that guy out? You know, just take them to court and everything. Like Allah says, do not displease me for the sake of to please another human being, because then you're not going to get anywhere.
Exactly. We have so many narrations saying that if you try to satisfy people, Allah leaves you upon them, and then you will only get dissatisfied by them all the time. Well, coming to you, Fatima, again, how can we change it? The woman also being like shown as a toy, less than that, the way she explained earlier. How can we change that?
I think also in the UK and some of these countries, the populations of Muslims are much more. And also they have a higher population of Muslim lawyers and people working in the court system. Like I remember reading, I think it was last year or 2 years ago, there was the first Muslim lady wearing hijab judge. All right. In the UK, whereas we have no such a thing in the US. Populations of Muslims in the US is growing, mm-hmm. and Canada, but it's not the same for the, you know, and they don't have as high position. There's no such a thing as lady judge, or there is, I'm sure, a lot of ladies lawyers wearing hijab. So if you can get a Muslim lawyer, I know they do have, there's called this CARE organization on the East Coast, I think in Washington, D.C. They do help Muslims with discriminatory cases, and they have Muslim lawyers. So that, I don't know how much work they've been able to do. I think they've succeeded in some, but you really got to have a lot of money in the U.S. to take anything to the court, number one. Number two, if you can get with one of those organizations that help people in the discriminatory things, I think it helps. But again, they don't have as much power, I think, as Muslims in the U.K. and these other countries. They have more populations, more in higher positions.
All right.
But at the end of the day, it's very difficult to, get these things taken care of. That was one of the reasons why I really decided to leave the U.S. and to immigrate and get out, because I was so tired of this situation that we're not able to get our
and it's so difficult, like not everyone like you can start immigrating and coming out.
Yeah, it's
US
very difficult.
It
very,
has
very
to
difficult.
Change.
I had a very specific set of situation that Allah really helped me. Allah, most of the people cannot. And then even a lot of people who come from the West, they can only stay here temporarily to study. It's very difficult.
Well,
but inshallah, it improves as time goes on. So I hope so, yeah.
Well, you are listening to Back to Reality. Here we need to take a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We have been talking about laws. There are laws, there are discriminatory laws. But in practical, we don't see much happening. As the Islamic Revolution leader Ayatollah Khamenei says that this is an age of Cold War, and we need to be more active on the media. So what do you think? What's your take on this note that what can we do? How can we change this? Like, I go to a page, or my son, like, he opens a game, and all of a sudden, some Barbies, nude Barbies, come on the
screen.
They
want to influence the kids.
I just get confused how to close the page, because you get so much disturbed.
Yes,
you don't even. Yes. I mean, I forget the cursor. I forget so many things while you know
the online movies, everything. It's everywhere.
Things come up. Yeah. Unfortunately, even if you're reading a news, even if you're reading something very important, even if you're reading something very resourceful, something like that will come up on the top of the site, on the bottom of the site, even on the very top news sites. We have right, left, coming up these things. What can we do to change that? Because we have to read the stuff as well. Our kids need to play games as well to be busy sometimes. What can we do to change that, especially living in this Cold War area?
First, we definitely should not get off social media, right? As Muslims, we need to be out there on Twitter, Instagram. We need to be able to interact with the wider community. Secluding ourselves is not going to get us much. But everything we can do with safety. One thing I have on my phone is pop-up blockers, advert blockers. I'm not sure how there would be ways to, you know, how you have cookies, and then I always reject all the cookies,
all right?
So after that, there will be a trace left behind, but it's not as intrusive now, in, downloading pop-up blockers, downloading advert blockers, so that there's less amount of adverts just being put on the screen. When it comes to children, not leaving them alone any technology.
To do a supervision.
Yeah, unfortunately, YouTube has this. At the start of a video, they have a 15-second, 20-second clip.
Yeah.
Some of them are really bad. Not leaving kids with that 15, 20-second worth of advert.
That 20-second can have a huge impact.
I was on a YouTube video that was, it had nothing indecent, right? And then the video, and then the advert came up. Good Lord, I was absolutely like, I started shivering when
pack.
I saw it. I like, good Lord, how did, you know, this video has nothing indecent, but this advert is so indecent that I will never allow, an adult, feel absolutely ashamed. If that phone was in my three-year-old son's hand, I would have to take him for a lot of purification.
They want to influence the children, yeah, shaitani.
Yeah,
so we have to don't leave the kids alone.
They have parental controls on certain things. I'm not sure. Yeah.
YouTube has a YouTube Kids section now.
Yeah.
If you have very young kids, so you have a YouTube Kids only that. They have this really nice Quran with the strings running in the background. It really excites the child to see, especially if you have very young children who love cars.
Mm-hmm.
So even introducing them to much more information-based videos, something that would be useful for them. Let's face it, we can't take videos away from them, but we can introduce them to videos that would be maybe more useful.
They have the Quranic apps for kids and these things.
Yeah, so even from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, you have this beautiful hadith. It's like your children, you know, that child is like this plain land that you can sow. And then what you sow, you reap in the future. So if we can just be a bit more careful and have a bit more responsibility with their technology, inshallah, you know, we can, although I'm not saying we can always avoid it, but we can try.
Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, Sadiqa. Thank you so much, Fatima. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIP English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازقة يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازقة Let us see daylight again, once again.
The 8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Yeah.
Iran, sponsor of regional unrest or victim of terrorism? Former Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Mousavi says Iran is the biggest victim of terrorist actions, which have been taken mainly with the U.S. government's direct and indirect support. Well, the MEK, a cult-like terror group that killed 17,000 Iranians, partly in collaboration with the enemy Saddam Hussein in time of war, is now nestled in Albania, in Europe, as its headquarters. But the MEK's got more than that. It's got strongholds in several Western hotspots that host more than the MEK or MKO. While this organization is out to overthrow the establishment and take over itself, other armed terror groups, such as Al-Ahwaziya, are out to separate whole Iranian provinces. And they, too, have their members nestled away in the world's hotspots, or supported by them, at least. Now, what's a wonder is how Western governments have managed to keep these criminals among their own people this long. To see how and why this happens, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Sweden appears to want a prisoner swap to rescue a designated Israeli spy. That would be an Ahmad Reza Jalali for a Hamid Nouri. Jalali is an Iranian, well now Swedish-Iranian, who was arrested during an academic visit to Iran in 2016 and accused of spying for Israel to help it assassinate several senior nuclear scientists. This is while Nouri was arrested upon entering Sweden in 2019 and is on trial for war crimes. Hard as it might be to believe Dr. Jalali, an academic, would commit treason, Sweden's support makes you wonder, given it would be an unequal prisoner swap, case-wise and time-wise.
When the topic of prison exchange is raised, a swap is for when the two sides are charged with the same crimes and there's a balance. But when a person who was a simple judiciary official was taken into custody years after his retirement on a trip by an illegal court for completely political reasons is put on trial, you cannot ask for a swap here with a real spy. We are certain Jalali is charged for spying, but we won't go into the details of that case. Nonetheless, espionage by this person may have been proven, and he may have received a death sentence. In essence, the charges against these two people are not the same and are independent cases. And these efforts to make this swap take place shows that the Sweden government really wants Jalali. Meaning if Jalali was not important to the Swedish government, it wouldn't try to reclaim him.
Iran has no intention of doing a swap or releasing Jalali for that matter. Judiciary spokesman Zabiullah Khodayan on May the 10th confirmed there was no connection between the Jalali and Nouri cases, unless perhaps Nouri was arrested for a swap or sending a message to the Iranian government.
Hamid Nouri was arrested, held in solitary confinement for a very long time and denied the right to an attorney, and during this time under various pressures he was deprived of basic rights given by civilized countries. But the strangeness of this case comes when the Swedish court begins procedures and the prosecutor reads the indictment. Then it's the turn of the plaintiffs, who are former members of the Mujahideen Khal organization, or the MKO, and they express their legal action against the defendant, and witnesses give their testimony against the defendant, meaning Hamid Nouri. We see that no witness testimony is given against Hamid Nouri, neither from witnesses nor those who are members of the MKO.
A Norway-based campaign group, Iran Human Rights, has accused Iranian officials of threatening to execute Jalali in retaliation for the war crimes trial of Nouri. But Jalali was convicted 2 years earlier than Nouri, so if anything, it would work the other way around. Iran's Supreme Court upheld the death sentence for Jalali in 2017, and he will be executed by 21st of May this year. This is while Nouri was arrested in 2019 and faces life in jail. Jalali was given Swedish citizenship in late February 2018, according to Stockholm. International human rights organizations claim Jalali confessed under torture. How do we know that he is a spy indeed?
The case of Jalali has no relation with the case of Hamid Nouri. Mr. Jalali was arrested 2 years before Hamid Nouri. He was a doctor in Iran before leaving the country. He had links with the Israel spy agency Mossad. He was in communication with them and had leaked intelligence to Mossad. While he was in the country, he worked with two strategic ministries on a project basis. In a set of televised confessions, it says he came to Iran and collected information on the whereabouts of Shahid Shahriari and Shahid Ali Mohammadi. When Jalali goes back to Europe, he was in communication with Mossad. He was fully aware that he wasn't taking scientific information out of the country.
But Nouri in Sweden was charged with international war crimes and human rights abuses in connection with the executions of more than 100 people at Gohardasht prison in Karaj in 1988, the key phrase being in connection with. Sounds awful, except that claims against him are mostly implied by the MKO. Regional terror groups are no enigma, and there's no question of their crimes. The same goes for Iran's homegrown terrorists. Anti-Iran groups that are housed and or supported by the West via Iran's regional rivals, such as Saudi Arabia, and partly at the behest of Israel, the West's military camp in the region, West Asia.
Last year, the Lebanese newspaper Ra'y Al Yawm published a series of important documents about cyber units and robots. Israeli regime has roughly 100 units in this regard. It's interesting to know these units even use schools and students to influence various political figures in different countries. It's not limited to Iran. They're also investing in Arab fields as well. Saudi Arabia is doing the same. The New York Times newspaper reported Saudi Arabia has invested some $150 million in this field to expand its cyber war network.
The Mojahedina Khalq organization, MKO or MEK, was established in 1965 in a bid to overthrow the Shah or King at gunpoint. It harbored an anti-Western and anti-US ideology and even killed many US officials in this country. Not to leave the best of the Americans out, they also kidnapped the US ambassador to Iran. Former US President Bill Clinton designated the group as an FTO, Foreign Terrorist Organization, in 1997. While it was on that terror list, however, it received training from the Bush administration, according to the prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh. The MEK training took place at the Department of Energy's Nevada National Security Site, about 65 miles northwest of Las Vegas. Finally, in 2012, the U.S. State Department removed the MEK from its list of designated terrorist organizations. This happened under intense lobbying by groups associated with Saudi Arabia and other regimes opposed to Iran, basically Israel. In spite of having mustered up nothing but hate in Iran, the MEK cult has never been a burnt-out card to the U.S. itself. If not for action in overthrowing the Iranian establishment, they have their uses for espionage. It was revealed by a 2012 NBC News report that MEK's brutal assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists has been committed via training and arming by Israel's Secret Service.
Any security intelligence agency needs people who are completely familiar with the culture of subjects of interest. For example, for the British, Germans, French, and Dutch, it's very important to employ Iranians so that they can analyze for them issues that concern Iran. Because a real Iranian national has every quality to analyze matters related to Iran rather than someone who learns Farsi as a second language, meaning they are attractive subjects for intelligence and security organizations. These individuals are employed by European intelligence agency, notwithstanding their backgrounds, and are active and even give asylum rights. These individuals are later used as pressure leverage against the Iranian government to force it to accept their request.
Whatever the early motive of the founders of the group MEK and whatever their cause for such bitterness, basically not being allowed to run in post-revolutionary presidential elections and so forth, their actions have nothing to show other than rot at the core of the group's ideology and later leaders. What they present as their militant revolutionary belief is an unfitting amalgamation of opposing ideologies, Islam, Marxism, and democracy, while they practice none. And they run the organization as a cult with extreme measures and cruelty for members and not leaders. To receive guidance with no distraction, members must devote all love and worship to the rulers Mr. and Mrs. Rajavi, who were joined by a very inexplicable marriage. Having participated in overthrowing the Shah in a bid to share power post-revolution and having failed in the latter, the MKO bombed the headquarters of the Islamic Republic Party, killing Mohammad Beheshti, the party leader, and scores of others. 2 months later, they killed the newly elected President Rajai and Prime Minister Bahonar by an embedded bomb. And so they moved to Iraq in 1986 and allied with Saddam, providing him with intelligence and even militarily attacking Iran. Now my question is, how might the Iranian system have performed so poorly for anyone outside to presume a group hated by Iranians for their treasonous acts of terror might stand a chance here? Or for a group like Al-Ahwaziyya to presume infiltration into and recruiting from the populace? The name Al-Ahwaziyya refers to Ahwaz city in Iran's oil-rich south.
The separatist schools of thought and anti-revolution sentiments have existed since the beginning of the victory of the Iranian Islamic Revolution. In the early days after the revolution, you could see the Democratic Party in Kurdistan. Another example is the Communist Union in the city of Amul in the north of Iran, or the separatists of Sistan and Balochistan and Khuzestan provinces. These have continuously existed and the enemies used them against the Iranian government. Their objective isn't to influence ordinary people. Their goal is to use these factions to divide and separate portions of the country.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
In brewing trouble and trying to divide and rule, America, be it Trump's America or Israel's America, was pandering quite a lot to Iran's Kurds. This is while the MKO served as an asset to Saddam Hussein when it came to his bloody crackdown on the Iraqi Shia and Kurdish populations.
Even before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, this very same MKO terrorist group played a key role in the assassination of American engineers, who used to work at Iran's oil industry, in the province of Khuzestan. But after the revolution, these terrorists first fled to Iraq and then to some European countries. During the Shia Intifada in 1991, against Saddam in the south of Iraq, the MKO group assisted Saddam in the mass murder of these Iraqis. Statistics indicate that over 150,000 of Iraqi Shias were murdered at that time.
Press reports cite MKO or MEK leader Maryam Rajavi encouraging members, "Take the Kurds under your tanks and save your bullets for the Iranian Revolutionary Guards," as cited by the New York Times of 2003. Understandably, Saddam Hussein backed them till his end in 2003. What isn't understandable is why a supporter and needler of Kurds, America, or an advocate of human rights, Sweden, would support the group. They've done despicable things to one another. Members have fallen victim to victimize.
The members of these terrorist groups, such as the MKO, who are active in Germany, France, the Netherlands, and other places, have published so much content against one another. Each one blames the other of killings, torture, and human rights abuses. It's interesting that all of these books have been written and published in Europe, meaning the members of this organization have probably